This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Father's Day is this Sunday. There will be a lot of homemade brunches and cards written in endearingly large child handwriting. But what are the deeper rewards of fatherhood? And what stresses do our culture and government policies place on modern dads? In 1960, according to the Pew Research Center, only one in four married couples with young kids had two income households. Now, in the majority of households, both parents work. That's changed the roles of mothers and fathers. More dads say they share in the childcare and housework than before. About half of the fathers surveyed said they wish they could stay home with their kids, but they need the money and have to work. And increasingly, dads worry about work-life balance. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to explore modern fatherhood and talk with dads about what they experience. If you'd like to chime in, we would love to hear from you. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. How do you feel like your role as a dad is different from your dad's? Do you feel pressure to act in a certain way as a father? Again, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Our guests today think about fatherhood in both personal and professional perspectives. Josh Miller is fatherhood coordinator at the Visiting Nurse Association Family Room and vice president of the Vermont Fatherhood Initiative, and he's dad to four boys. Josh, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And David Ratu is the head of the Pediatric Psychiatry Clinic at the UVM Medical Center, and he's a professor at the medical school. He's the father of three boys. They're between 3 years old and 15 years old. David Ratu, pleasure to have you back on the show as well.
It's great to be back, Jane.
So, as I said, you're both dads, dads of boys. In fact, I'd love to ask you just personally first how you feel like your style of parenting or your role as a dad is different from the role your father played in your life. Josh Miller?
Well, I grew up without a father, so I grew up with a single mom, myself and my sister, and so my life with my children is very different from what I grew up in. Which I think is actually, Dave and I were talking earlier about, you know, what it was like to grow up without a dad and how it affects my parenting. And I think that it's been allowed me to have it be pretty open. I've been able to sort of create that role, and be kind of whatever dad that I want to be. And it's been great and challenging too. So
when you look at it, you see it as this opportunity to forge your own way and not to be stuck in trying to compare yourself to your dad. But is it also challenging to not have had that role model in your life, to sort of have an dad to look at as your ideal?
Yeah, I think for a long time it was pretty challenging and not knowing sort of how, you know, what my role was and sort of searching for that and looking sort of outside of myself and my own experience to what it meant to be a dad. And I think that question and that search has led me to, you know, my professional life to be there and work with dads and help answer that. So it's been a mixed blessing. So,
David Ratu, what about for you?
Well, I started with a more traditional family layout, I think. My dad was a very steady hand. He worked, was away during the day while my mother was at home, at least in the beginning. He was a teacher. He was very warm but a bit reserved, and also somebody who was a disciplinarian. And there was a little bit of fear involved, never for my safety, but I always knew if I misbehaved, I'd have to answer for it.
So you got the wait till dad comes home and he'll deal with you kind of thing?
Well, my mother was okay at doing that herself. But yes, there was a bit of that. And my father was somebody who my mom will point out never did diapers and stuck to more traditional models. But he taught me how to play baseball and gave me a lot of life lessons that I still remember today.
You've got three kids. How many diapers have you changed?
Quite a few.
So different role.
Yeah, I think I'm finally out of that phase now.
So how do you see your role as different? You know, do you think your kids will have the same idea of what you were like as you do of your father?
I think it will be different. In our own household, there's much more of a shared – both my wife and I do work outside of the home and inside the home. We share in our responsibilities, and I think that's a model that our kids are seeing and that we're explicitly trying to teach them. In my house, for instance, I cook and my wife cleans up, and I try to teach my boys how to cook. And I don't know if that was not something that was part of my life growing up.
This may sound kind of derivative, but both of you work with a lot of different kinds of parents. You see a lot of parenting styles. You think about what it takes to be a good parent and try to help people in that direction. And often that means a different approach depending on what your kids are like. But what does it actually mean to be a good dad? What are the characteristics of a good father? Josh?
I love that question. I think a big one is willing to do whatever it is that needs to happen, whether it's, you know, the cooking or the cleaning. It's, you know, taking care, you know, being willing to jump in and change the diaper. But also the stuff that I think that's really fun about being a dad, which is, you know, jumping in and playing with them, you know, running around, chasing the boys. And I mean, I've been doing that for a long time now. And I think doing that, but I think it's a lot of, you know, modeling the you know, sharing, like, you know, sharing the role, sharing the responsibilities. And that I think, you know, working together to help get done what needs to get done. I think it's that there's just a lot of cooperation involved, whether it's, you know, with our partners or with our children, just trying to really set up a set a tone of cooperation. Yeah.
And I would say before we kind of wade too deep in this, when we talk about fathers or we talk about mothers, I think it's easy to slip into a discussion that really brings in a lot of gender stereotypes. And it's probably worth mentioning that even though, yes, maybe statistically it's true that dads tend to do more rough and tumble play, there really is no reason why those kinds of activities that have traditionally been associated with dads have to stay that way. And there are plenty of households, particularly in Vermont, I think, where those roles are crossed. And that's great.
Like what? Give me more examples.
Well, I think in terms of who is the disciplinarian, who does more of the rough and tumble play, who's the parent who tends to push kids versus being the more the nurturer or the comforter. You know, there are these different roles that people play, and I think it's a lot more equal now, and it should be.
You said particularly in Vermont. Why might Vermont be different?
Well, I think Vermont just has a great diversity of families, and so I think we have this experience with lots of different households where there's single parents or two moms or two dads, and that just provides for a very rich experience.
Josh, do you agree?
Yeah, I think the traditional roles have shifted a bit. I work with actually a lot of stay-at-home dads, guys that are doing that role that traditionally has been, you know, mom has done and dad comes home and he's been working all day. And I see, and it's great. And I think that they go through a lot of the same things that moms, you know, would go through and you know, home all day with the kids. But I think it's, again, like, you know, what it means to be a good dad and is doing what, you know, whatever needs to be done. And our kids need a lot. It's really demanding all the time. So.
Well, I would say I was lucky. I have two dads and two moms. I have two step-parents who also parented me and got really great examples from four parents of what it's like to be a parent. And both my mom and my stepmother work. My dad works. My stepfather spent a lot of time working from home and was that sort of main child caregiver to me and my brother when we were little. So we've had a lot of examples of what it's like to have this sort of modern family and move among and between gender roles. So I hear a lot of what you're saying. Let's go to Mary, who's calling in from Springfield. Hi, Mary, you're on.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. I'm on the road. I have raised three sons as a single parent, and I would love to have it be Parents' Day, because if you were to ask those three sons who, like your first interviewer there, spoke about being a single parent family, they would say no male, none, not an uncle, not a grandfather, no one stood up, not a teacher, no one came into their lives as a male role model. And to me, that's part of the education system where they, you know, exactly do tell you, you know, on Mother's Day and Father's Day, write about this. And it's a very painful thing for single parents, as well as for parents who happen to be grandparents who are raising the children. So I would like to broaden that conversation and say, you know, hooray for parents. You know, if you had a good parent, that would be fantastic. Have a Parents' Day.
So, Mary, Father's Day for you then doesn't feel like a celebration.
Oh, no, not for any of them. No, I mean, sometimes my kids take me out for Father's Day and Mother's Day just because that's what I was. I had to do it all, which is difficult.
Yeah, yeah, to say the least. Mary, thank you for calling. Thanks for sharing your perspective. Josh Miller, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I appreciate you calling and that putting it to a parent's day. And, you know, my mother did everything. She did a lot with very little. And I think that, you know, that was probably a day to celebrate her a lot. And it wasn't a very fond day for us either. You know, we both, my sister and I, grew up without a father, which was hard. But it was, you know, it was a day that... you know, kind of for us, just kind of pass by. But I think it's a good day to acknowledge parents and all those who are working really hard to raise their kids.
You know, David Ritu, you mentioned that often when we start talking about Mother's Day and Father's Day and parenting roles, we get really into gender stereotypes. But Mary mentioned that for her kids, there were no men who stepped up to act as role models in their lives. And you could hear, it seemed to me, maybe some anger about that, some sadness. Does it matter? You know, if we're trying to get away from gender stereotypes and anybody can be rough and tumble, do kids need a male role model, a father figure in their lives?
Well, my heart goes out to the caller. And I think kids can grow up and thrive and be very emotionally healthy and well-adjusted in families without a father. When kids grow up, one of the many tasks that they have is to help them find an identity as a man, as a woman, as a boy, and as a girl. And I think it is easier if you have role models that you can point to, but that doesn't make it impossible, and it certainly doesn't mean that there are some good workarounds. And some people have found those role models in coaches and in teachers, in mentorship programs, and I think it is worth trying to find those people if you can.
Josh?
Yeah, I agree. I think that kids can be raised by their mother and be great, wonderful people and have great childhood experiences. But I know for myself from personal experience that it was a struggle to not have a male role model. And I, you know, had different people pass through my life that I didn't necessarily respect and really sought that out as I got older. It's always been a very important part of me and my identity to seek out men who I respected and looked up to and could sort of follow them in their lead. So I think that there's a good value to seeking that out, and that could come from a lot of different places. And it's, you know, I think it, you know, not, and I think the caller is doing a lot and to maybe think about how to help put her sons in a position to find some, you know, a good male role model, you know, and talk to them about it too. You know, I don't know how old they are, but I think that could be helpful as well.
We're talking about fatherhood today, and we'd love to hear your experiences, or you can share questions with us. Is the perception of what makes a good dad changing? Do you feel like it's different now than it was perhaps when you were a kid? Where do you feel like you fit in? Does our society make it easy to be a good dad, or are there things that you see as barriers? What could change to make it easier? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or we've opened up a conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, and you're welcome to post there. Mark says, fatherhood is like most everything else in life. What you and your kids get out of it is proportional to what you put into it. Being a good father is all about jumping in with both feet, not simply throwing up your hands and assuming that dads just can't do certain things or shouldn't have to do certain things with and for their kids. We don't need to make it easier to be a good father. We need to expect fathers to be good fathers and to grade moms and dads using the same rubric. What do you think about that, David Ritu? Should moms and dads be on the same scale for grading?
Yeah, I like that comment, and I like the comment about it being difficult. And I can remember with my own kids, often in the beginning, I used to tell them about my successes in life, and I've gotten more to telling them about my failures. Telling them the stories of when I struck out in the league or when I just made a horrible fool of myself asking a girl to dance. And I think it's important to be able to tell the whole picture as part of being a good dad.
Should moms and dads be graded the same, Josh Miller?
Graded the same. Well, I don't know who's doing the grading, but I would say that, you know, at the end of it was the expectation that fathers are anting up as much as moms are. And I think in all of, you know, there have been sort of maybe some more traditional roles, and we're, you know, I think that's changing a bit. But I think that, you know, expecting dads to be there and creating a culture that is really that we're expecting dads to be parents and not so much just the play guy or, you know, the guy expecting them just to, you know, do some of those things that they've done for a long time. But I think we as the, you know, as bringing in the nurturing piece of it, bringing in some, you know, for my first son, you know, I think that I was the play guy and I didn't really do a lot of the stuff around setting up appointments and doing the things that sort of the hard work and getting the kids to the doctor's appointments, taking off work. And mom did that a lot. And I think that that's, you know, we need to figure out how to get guys to meet the expectation of parent and what that really means and all of what that means as we define parenting. So I think the expectations for dads need to be raised a lot.
Well, you know, that's interesting. You said, I don't know who's grading you. And I mean, everybody is in some ways, you know, and I don't know. I don't know if there is as much focus on dad shaming and dad guilt as there seem to be in the mommy circles. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just in teasing this program on our promos, we talked about the sort of flip sides of fatherhood in that way that, you know, it often seems or there's a perception that a dad at the playground playing with his kids or a dad who takes his kids to the grocery store, you know, gets showered with praise for, oh, my gosh, what a good dad you are. And, you know, there's a lot of teeth grinding from some moms who say, I do that every day and I don't get praise. Mm-hmm. But then there is that flip side of dads who say, I have a lot of pressure at work. If I want to leave to go to a kid's doctor's appointment, I don't feel like I can. I don't feel like that's accepted at my job. Or I don't feel like the policies that are in place apply as equally to dads as to moms. Or I go to a public place with my kid and there's no diaper changing station in the restroom. I can't even change my kid's diaper in a clean, sanitary place. Yeah. So, I mean, how do we make it easier if we've got, you know, this judgment on one side that says you're a good dad just for playing with your kids, but then this other sort of perception that, well, dads don't do as much, so we're not even going to put the policies in place to make it easier.
Yeah. And so that's the big change that we need to make is, you know, from diaper changing tables in the men's bathroom, which I think, you know, I'm seeing more and more of, but I think too, you know, the systems and the way we approach dads around fatherhood and parenting. So, you know, I think about things like going to the doctor or school and how men are addressed, the fathers are addressed, and even expecting men to be there. Like, it's at school events that we see, you know, dad there and they're representing and they're there during the school conferences. I think that those things are, you know, we want teachers to ask. Where's dad? How can we get dad more involved in their kids' education and at the doctor that we, you know, work on, you know, the doctor speaking with both the parents and I think creating that level of expectation and you know, wanting to speak with both parents about that, I think will some of those things, some of the policies in workplaces are, you know, they need to, some people might need to say, I need to go to my appointment with my child and might need to deal with some consequences with that. I don't know if that's the right method, but I think that some things like that need to change for dads to really meet that expectation of being there.
I know in our old child mental health clinic, we really try to make a point to reach out to dads. Very often when we're seeing a family for the first time, we'll see the child and often the mother. And we'll really make a point to say, can we get the dad in? Can we hear their perspective? And that is really a crucial part. And that's an expected part of our evaluation.
What about for you? And I don't mean to ask you to call out your own employer, but do you feel like in your life you're able to say, my kid's sick, I'm staying home today. Sorry, I know that's a problem, but I'm the dad.
I feel very lucky with my own employers that they do allow me for that flexibility and I am able to work around my schedule. But I think that has to do with my job as working for the university and the hospital, allowing some flexibility rather than it being a dad. But I really wish more people would have that opportunity and that would be the expectation.
Again, today we're talking about fathers. We're talking about fatherhood. We are looking at how this works for dads in Vermont and beyond. And if you want to share your experiences with us, please give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send us a note. You can write to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Josh Miller is the Fatherhood Coordinator at the Visiting Nurses Association Family Room and Vice President of the Vermont Fatherhood Initiative. He's the father of four boys. David Ritu is the head of the Pediatric Psychiatry Clinic at UVM Medical Center, and he's a professor at the medical school. He's the father of three boys. They're sharing their personal and professional perspectives on fatherhood today, and we're hearing from many of you. How's your parenting style different from your dad's? Do you see changes in a culture of fatherhood in this generation? You can give us a call with your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211, or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Trudy writes in to say, our daughter was born to old parents who you would think would be influenced by gender, but no. My husband had to care for her as an infant as I worked nights. He made her lunches, laundry, dressing, sewing, etc. He was the one she went to for comfort. I do all the financial stuff and I keep the household running. I'm so proud of how she's been parented. She has no role expectations based on gender. And let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Bill. Your thoughts.
Yes, hi. My name is Bill Jauber. I'm from Rutland. And I was involved in starting a father's rights group in the early 2000s called Vermont Dad. And I just wanted to say that there's a lot of fathers out there that have struggled very hard to get a fair visitation with their children. So I think that's a side of the story that needs to be shared here also. There's many fathers that are not given the same rights as mothers are. And in a lot of cases, there's not really a good reason for that.
Bill, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Josh Miller, do you have experience with that? My understanding of the Vermont court system is that it's still weighted towards mothers in custody battles rather than weighted towards an assumption of joint custody. It's sort of more of an assumption of maternal custody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bill's clearly frustrated by that.
Yep. A lot of guys experience that. I mean, that's hearing they'll talk about that. It's very common for a lot of guys who are trying to figure out, you know, things didn't work out the way they want them to. And so they're dealing with custody and how to be able to even just see their child, their children. And it's hard and it's really frustrating. And, you know, there aren't a lot of easy answers for that. You know, when I come across a guy, you know, who's going through that and really just supporting him and his process and is really the best that we can do sometimes. But it's been a very frustrating piece. And I think that's part of, you know, we think about the systems and the changes that we try to, you know, figure out how can we help support dads more in that.
I think Vermont's in the minority of joint custody only being possible if both parents agree to it. And that law, I think, put some pressure on often dads getting into the role of being the weekend entertainer rather than being a true parent who has to do all of the day-to-day nitty-gritty that is really important to be a father. And I think that is something that should be looked at, and the legislature, I hope, will do that.
So you'd like to see that law changed to have it less weighted towards the maternal custody?
Yes, I would like it to be a decision that a judge could make rather than having that decision being taken away from them because of the law.
Josh, you too?
Yeah. I think that, you know, we need to, I mean, as you know, our promotion is about dads being involved with their kids. And I think that that's, you know, and there are tough circumstances, but, you know, taking away that time that dads are seeing their kids, and there's valuable time, especially when, you know, children are young, that dads being involved early on is really important. And there's some guys go a long time without being able to have that time with their children.
Are there other policies that you'd like to see change, either of you, that would help dads or help even in our cultural assumptions about who fathers are and what their jobs are?
I would personally love to see something about paternity leave. Paternity leave is virtually non-existent in America, and that's not true for other countries. And I think not only does that provide a really important resource, but it sends also a critical message that, hey, you're part of this too, and you need to be there to support your infant and support the new mom as well.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I think that there's one of the pieces around the visitation is how to, you know, a lot of guys are required to pay child support, and that's not linked to visitation at all. So you could pay a lot of money for your child and not ever see them. And that's that would be very frustrating to be on the receiving end of that. And another piece, which is more, you know, the cultural piece, which is I really, you know, want to see, you know, other men supporting men in the parenting component. So that's another thing of how we can in media and in, you know, just how we have our conversations that we're out there. And it's a very different thing than, you know, the visitation piece, but really, you know, wanting to see more pressure, more guys pressuring guys to be there. And that they're, you know, sometimes you get the one token guy who's playing with the kids at the birthday party, and seeing guys getting out there, and guys are fun, and they want to, you know, they want to get down and get on their hands and knees and play with the kids. And I think that really men and professionally and also personally pushing the fatherhood on other guys. So, yeah.
Let's go to the call. Sam's on the line with us from Colchester. Hey, Sam, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a World War II orphan, raised by my grandmother. After the war ended, my Army aunt came home and married a GI who had just come home, and he moved in with us. They raised their four kids with us. We're kind of a Brady Bunch family. I also was a single parent. Two teenage, I was very young, right? I became a single parent. They've outgrown me nicely now. I'd do it all over again. Parenting was fun. Hard work was fun. I want to also put a plug in for a nurturing fathers program that is run by Prevent Child Abuse Vermont. It's a very good program, 13 weeks, no cost to the participants, and it's an evening once a week. So I'll put a plug for that. And if you call Child Abuse Vermont, and Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, it's based in Montpelier. But they run this program all of us.
Oh, Sam, I think we lost your line there, but thank you for your call. Really interesting to hear your perspective, and thanks for sharing that organization. Sam says there's a fatherhood initiative through the Prevent Child Abuse Vermont. We'll try to put a link to it up at vpr.net. But speaking of that, Josh Miller, your job, you are the head, the president of the Vermont Fatherhood Initiative, and your job at the Visiting Nurse Association is to run the family room, and you're the fatherhood coordinator there. So what are you doing in your professional work to do all this stuff that we've been talking about today?
Well, at the family room, it's a place for families, you know, moms, dads, kids, grandparents, uncles, aunts, you know, everybody that's involved in being a part of the kids. And we've been talking a lot about, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. And so that model is kind of what we do there. And specifically around the fathers, we do a Tuesday nights from 3 to 7. We do Vermont Dads does a dad's night and has the, you know, some play group for guys to come and hang out with their kids and be with other dads and talk and sort of, you know, connect like moms might do at a play group. Right. But it's really just a time for dads to spend great time with their kids. That's been happening for about, I think maybe 26, 27 years. but that's one piece of our program where we do a parenting class. We do a couple different classes for dads, try to give them a little more education around what's going on with their kids, support them around, you know, balancing all the pressures that we have to do as families, as dads, and single or married. We help guys. We do a relationships class, so I help guys. You know, that's a big part of having a family is just working together and figuring out all that needs to be done. So we help guys with communication around that, co-parenting, those kinds of things. And we also do employment. So helping guys, you know, help do some training, help with soft skills, help them, you know, build a resume and get out and seek either employment or improved employment. Which has been great. I think that's a big part of, you know, what guys need, you know, guys are looking for is to support their family. And so that's all that work is really important. We do a lot of stuff individually with guys. Guys have either they're not group guys or, you know, they have other things that they're working on and so we're able to support them, in a variety of different ways. So the family room is an incredible place where guys can come, you know, not just during dad's night, but other times and be with other families and get a lot of support with just, you know, being with their kids, being around other kids, networking with other parents, which is amazing to watch. There are a lot of caring people there. And as far as the Vermont Initiative, we're really, and that's the piece that we were talking about earlier, is just how do we get this stuff, you know, into the systems, into the institutions. And that's really our task is to connect all the different programs throughout Vermont. So we're all not trying to do it alone and we're collaborating with others but also helping people get to that place of creating a father-friendly environment for their families that they work with. But also, you know, working with schools, working some of the other places to really more effectively work with dads because I think that there are a lot of things that it's not that people aren't willing to change, but don't necessarily know how to do it. And so that's sort of our effort is to encourage engaging fathers, but, you know, kind of best practices to do. And so just having that conversation, we've been doing a conference for the past 4 years and that's really getting all the folks together and talking about how can we better do this. I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but that this is something I've been doing for a little while now. And you know, we're all trying to learn from each other and as we do as parents, right? You know, trying to figure it out together. And so that's sort of the other piece that I'm working on with the initiative there.
Well, and so interesting talking about role models earlier. You know, I think we often forget that you can have peer role models as well, you know, and certainly learn from each other as you're trying to figure out what best practices are. David Ritu, you wanted
to
jump in?
In our clinic, which is very family focused, I usually will try to ask the question about parenting, but I'll ask it this way in terms of what things do you think you're doing well and what things are you struggling with? And when you ask it that way, you're sort of giving people the allowance that everybody does some things pretty well and everybody struggles. Nobody is perfect. I certainly am not perfect. I think one of the things about being a child psychiatrist is that you make all the mistakes that every other parent does, except that you may be a little bit more aware of them. So you have to take that imperfection and not be satisfied with it, but accept it and then try to move on and get better.
Let's go to Montreal, where Grace is calling in from. Hi, Grace. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm an American originally, and I married a French-Canadian here in Montreal. And we're so lucky to have all of the support and services for working moms and dads. And as a teacher, when I first came, I had a year off maternity leave, partly paid, and fathers get 6 weeks off. My situation now, I have three boys. Youngest is 6 months old, and my husband's in the family business, and right now he's the sole moneymaker, and our split up of the family needs has changed a bit. And I'm curious about what your panelists have to think about when there is one sole bread earner and how they see the family, the home life.
Grace, do you mean like should the person who's the sole breadwinner not have to do as much vacuuming or getting up in the middle of the night with a 6 month old? Is that where you're going?
right. So essentially, I do everything. But he's wonderful when he's here. But it's such a hard thing to be the sole bread, money earner. And
Grace,
I'm wondering. I'm curious about.
Yeah, I hear you. And let's put that to our guests. And, you know, I'll tell you, I have a one-year-old, and my husband, when he's not working, does most of the household chores. But when there's a cry in the middle of the night, you know, regardless of who's getting up earlier, I think I'm probably the one that gets up more often at midnight or one or two or three or four or five and gets up and comforts our child. So, you know, what about that, David Ritu? I mean, some of it is just it's going to fall to one or the other of you, and some of it's gender stereotypes and gender roles and wage earning.
Yeah, I'd be reluctant to kind of weigh in on as the judge for an individual family. But I think the point is that there are a lot of things that need to be done, and we have to value all of those roles. And people can work hard at a job and come home tired, and we have to acknowledge that. And we also have to acknowledge how hard it is to be at home as well. So all of those things are important, and everybody has to strike the right balance.
All right. So since it is Father's Day on Sunday, I am going to throw my own dad a bone. He's called in here, Carl from Cornwall. Dad, this is tough for you, but you're going to have to make it quick.
Okay, this is Carl from Cornwall, long-time listener, rare caller. I just remember the anecdote when we were at the between marriages. I've one 12-year marriage, one 25-year marriage, four kids, two and two. And had the kids, Jane and David, quite often all by myself between marriages. We were at a beach in Maine, and we were having a good time, and a woman approached me and said, do they have sunblock on? You have to make sure they have sunblock on and be protected. And I remember resenting that, saying, you wouldn't say that to their mom. Mm. And so I think these gender stereotypes hold, and they probably come from somewhere. The only suggestion I would make real quickly is that even in the best marriages, intact marriages where there are kids, I think moms have to give dads a chance to be on their own with the kids all by themselves for an extended period. By that, I mean days or a week or two. Because I think moms sometimes can't watch dads do it. And dads have to make these mistakes, and sometimes they have to send the kids to school in unmatched clothes.
God forbid, Dad, I'm going to cut you off there. But I hear what you're saying, and I should tell my husband now. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. You got the kid. You're all set. Josh Miller is the Fatherhood Coordinator at the Visiting Nurse Association Family Room and Vice President of the Vermont Fatherhood Initiative, father of four boys. David Ritu is head of the Pediatric Psychiatry Clinic at UVM Medical Center. He's also a professor at the medical school. His book is called Child Temperament, New Thinking About the Boundary Between Traits and an illness. We had a conversation with him before about that on this show. Fascinating work. David, Josh, thank you both very much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, both the U.S. and Canadian women's soccer teams made it through the first round of the World Cup. One of the Canadian players grew up in the eastern townships of Quebec. We'll hear more about what makes her tick coming up next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you've been following the Women's World Cup soccer tournament, you know that the U.S. team made it out of the group stage of the tournament on top of the pile. So did the Canadian team in their group. It's always exciting for fans in the host country when their team is doing well. One of the stars of the Canadian team is José Bélanger, who grew up in Coaticook, Quebec, just over the border from Vermont. We called Sportsnet reporter Sandra Prusina, who joined us from Calgary before heading to work, to tell us about Bélanger and the Canadian team's prospects.
José Bélanger, she's been with the program actually for a number of years, but this marks her Women's World Cup debut. And that might seem a little bit funny because she's 29 years old and she's had a plethora of experience. But heading into the 2011 edition of the tournament, she was actually injured. So she completely missed out on Germany. And her injury to her ankle was so severe that she took time off of soccer. And I think she was so frustrated with the progression of her injury, or lack thereof progression of her injury, she almost decided to hang him up for good. But current Canadian head coach John Herdman gave her a call when she was in Quebec. She was doing a little bit of coaching. She was working with kids. And he said, "I would love for you to come back." And she kind of hemmed and hawed on the decision a little bit, not knowing if it was the right thing for her to do. And he actually went to Quebec to speak to her in person. And that's basically all she needed. And she's joined the team. She's made a difference. And the interesting thing about José right now is she's actually playing out of position. She's predominantly an attacking midfielder, or she plays as a forward. That's what she's known for. She's a very skilled player, very good with her feet. She can put the ball in the back of the net. But Canada's been hit quite hard with injuries. And because of her style of play, he's actually put her as a right back. And John Herdman really focuses on having a modern fullback. That's what he calls them. So he wants a fullback that can not only be responsible defensively, but somebody that can move up the pitch and get the ball to the forwards, cross it in, and be able to counterattack when they have the opportunity. And José, she's only played now 4 games in that position, and she's done an incredible job. She's fit in seamlessly. You can tell how skilled she really is when she has the opportunity to drive on that right side of the pitch. So she's been great. And I'm sure going into this tournament, if you would ask her a few months ago, if someone said, "Hey, can you imagine playing a defender in the Women's World Cup?" she probably would have laughed.
Although at least publicly, she's been saying she's enjoying it.
Yeah. And you can tell because this really allows her to display her talents, I think, because not only is she very good offensively, obviously, she's creative and can attack well, but she's also very strong. She's physically she's really into CrossFit and things like that. So you can tell that she is physically one of the strongest players on the team. So that's what makes her such a good defender, is she can keep the opposition to the outside and beat them to balls. And in a one-on-one situation, she can usually beat you. So it's been great to see her make this progression, albeit unexpectedly.
Hmm. So Canada finished at the top of Group A in this first round, and you think she's made a difference?
I really do, because he actually has a couple of fullbacks that haven't seen any time. However, I don't think they play the style of fullback that he wants. And José brings that. And that's certainly no disrespect to the players that are on the bench. I think just that having José on the field gives the team a bit of a different look. And the fact that you can be creative from the back into the attacking zone is huge. And that's what she brings to this team.
Speaking of some of the other players who aren't starters, there are 2 other Quebecers on the Canadian team, right?
Yeah.
And it must have been exciting for the whole team then to have that final game of the first round in Montreal at the Big O.
Absolutely. And they actually haven't played in Montreal for many, many years. So this was the first experience for José, for sure, to be able to play in Quebec, which is huge. And it's developed a lot of good players over the years. They are still developing good players. They have W League teams there. So it is a hub of women's soccer in Canada for sure. So to be able to see them, and especially given their ages, they're hitting kind of the twilight peaks of their careers. Rianne Wilkinson, Marie Evnaud, it's at that point in their careers where maybe they're not going to play in another major tournament. So I think to be able to share that at home with their family and friends meant a lot.
So if you could handicap the tournament, where do you see Canada coming in the end?
It's really, for me right now, it's really tough to say because I can truthfully say I don't think Canada's played as well as they could. I don't know if it's jitters of being the host nation of this. I can't say. I think it might be a little bit psychological, but at the same time, they're not scoring goals. And in a tournament like this, defense will only get you so far. So they absolutely need to put the ball in the back of the net.
Well, and just for people who haven't been paying attention, Canada won one match, right? And then it had a draw in two, and those were very low scoring. One was a 0-0 draw, yeah. And the other was a 1-1.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Yeah, so one win, two draws. Only two goals scored. One was on a set piece, so on a PK, and the second one was on an open play by Ashley Lawrence, a 20-year-old kid, youngster. So that was fantastic. She's actually the first person since 2007 to score for Canada at a Women's World Cup that wasn't Christine Sinclair. So that, to me, is an incredible stat. Like, that just tells you how important Christine is to Canada.
But so you think they haven't been playing at the top of their game? You think they could go all the way?
It's tough to say. Honestly, it depends who they face. Canada's had an issue over the past 5 or 6 years being able to beat that top echelon of teams. You know, the teams that are ranked 1 to 5, I don't know if Canada would be able to beat them right now. And that's certainly not a knock on Canada by any means, but that just tells you how good the top teams are. Canada can usually really play well against those teams that are in that same ranking as them. So you're looking at maybe 6 to 10 in that ranking group. But yeah, once you face Germany, Japan, USA, it's very, very tough for them because, well, Canada could match up to them good for maybe 45, 50, 60 minutes. Those teams have so many options coming off the bench. Well, Canada doesn't have that depth there. So that's going to be an issue, I think, if they do progress in the tournament, because these other teams have other weapons while Canada really doesn't.
And is that due to the injuries that you mentioned before, or is that just a depth problem that the team has anyway?
Injuries are definitely an issue, but I think it's both. Not to have Diana Matheson in the lineup to me is huge. She's the second or third most experienced player on this team next to Christine Sinclair, not only in caps, but in goals scored. So you're taking away those goals. You're taking away someone that does nearly all of your set pieces. She's been able to perform on a big stage throughout her entire career. We saw what she did at the Olympics for Canada in 2012. And then on the right back position where Jose has been playing, that has predominantly for at least the past 5 or 6 years belonged to Rianne Wilkinson, another French player we were just talking about. And just not to have her out on the pitch, she's very vocal, she's a great leader. So that too is a loss, I would say, regardless of the fact that Jose has filled in seamlessly. It does take away not having Rianne on the pitch because she's been a starter for many, many years and a leader for the youngsters that end up on that back line, like someone like Kadisha Buchanan.
For people who think it would be neat to see a matchup between the USA and Canada, that's not going to happen unless both teams get to the final round, as I see it, right?
That is correct. Yeah, I've kind of gone through all the permutations, and basically, that would be Canada's road to the final, and it would end with a final against the U.S. at BC Place in Vancouver, yeah.
So what's this like for you to cover the World Cup and for Canada to be hosting it? It's certainly not the first time Canada has hosted the World Cup, but what's the atmosphere like?
It's really neat because obviously you have people that love soccer in Canada. We have a lot of immigrants here who grew up watching soccer, playing soccer. So you have that niche market that watches soccer 365 days a year. However, when a tournament like this happens, it really connects other people who don't necessarily follow soccer, but they want to be proud of the Canadian athletes and we're putting our country on display. So you have people asking, for example, you know, I work in a newsroom and people will call in and ask, when is Canada's next match? Or what does Canada have to do to move on in the tournament? So maybe they don't know the basics, but they want to know and they want to be part of this tournament. And they're really proud to be hosting it because Canadians as a whole maybe aren't as obviously patriotic as some countries are, but we really, really do love this country and we're so proud to see it on the world stage.
Sandra, when you say they call the newsroom, do they actually call up and ask questions like that? Like, when's the next match? I need to make sure I'm ready. They actually call the newsroom?
Yeah, they'll reach out through the newsroom or people will reach out on Twitter and stuff and ask questions. So it's neat to see just the interest. And I think once this tournament is said and done, you will see an uptick and a spike in terms of registration for boys and for girls, because the tournament features, when you hear the backstories behind some of these players and those ones that are featured in this tournament and how hard they work to get to this level, and the fact that most of them haven't been paid as much as their male counterparts, you really connect with these players. And as a result, I think we'll see interest in soccer definitely go up.
That's reporter Sandra Prusina of Sportsnet. Thank you so much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I don't think I've ever done an American interview. So
it wasn't too bad then.
No, it was perfect. Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow on the program, St. Michael's College professor Bill Grover. In his new book, The Unsustainable Presidency, the political scientist looks at whether a democratic form of government and a capitalist economy can address the needs of a majority of citizens. Grover joins us on the show to talk about his new book and some possible solutions to the gridlock that he sees facing the United States today. So tune in for that discussion tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.